It's Dr. Robin Lovelace, and he is, I'll keep quiet for here, University Academic Fellow in Spatial Modelling and Dynamics with the Institute of Transport Studies at the University of Leeds. And he's going to talk about what it says on the screen, going Dutch, crunching big transport, transport big data for a sustainable world. Over to you, Robin.
Okay. Thank you very much for the introduction. Okay, yeah, firstly, thanks to Paul and Dave for organising this. It's really fantastic to have this opportunity to be able to present our work, and amazing to see such a turnout, let alone to see cycle modelling, which is quite a niche subject at the best of times, plus on a Monday evening. So I'm really, really happy at the turnout, and thank you very much, everyone, for coming along. As Paul says, I'm Robin. I work at the Institute for Transport Studies, and my job title is actually Transport and Big Data. That's why we've got that in the slides. But actually, the main topic of the talk is going Dutch and what that means and how big data can help us to understand how we can change the transport system to be much more sustainable than what it currently is. And I don't know how everyone got here this evening. I cycled appropriately, but I could see lots of people stuck in traffic on the way over. I could smell the air pollution coming from some of the vehicles and some of the buses, and I could see that this is not an optimal system. So you'll be happy to hear that the emphasis of this talk is not on the big data. That and all of the methods is actually quite a lot of programming and hundreds of lines of code and equations that I could show. But ultimately, the reason that we're doing this is to try and provide evidence to build a more sustainable world. So I don't want the emphasis to be on the data. I want the emphasis to be on how do we create a sustainable world. However, I think it's fair to say that the newly available data and newly available ways of analysing the data make it much easier to decide how we move to a sustainable transport system. So we are better equipped than ever before to understand the problems, to be able to predict what might happen in the future, and also to take action to prevent bad things happening. So that's a little bit of context in there, but I'll come back to that after giving an overview of what I'm going to be talking about. So I've got a few more things to say on the motivations of why we're doing this work. So I think that's all there is to say about me. The other thing to say probably is that I'm not actually a transport expert by training. My area of expertise, as Paul alluded to, is geography, essentially, or spatial modelling. That's what they call geography these days. It is
computers as well, aren't
you? Yeah, I mean, it's definitely much more computerised, but you'll be happy to know there's lots of maps on there, and most of the maps are of Leeds. So people in this room will probably know a thing or two about it, and I also hope to learn from you. So I was saying earlier, I don't know a huge amount about the policy context. My job is to provide evidence, and then it's up to decision makers, politicians and citizens to decide how to use that evidence. So that's another thing to say. I've got a very simple outline, and I don't actually have that many slides because I think having a lot of audience interaction is important. So if anyone has a question at any point, just put your hands up, that's fine. I'm going to talk about what that actually means in the local context where we are, and just a question of where can we take the results of our research and what can we do about it, both in terms of the research and in terms of at the individual level, what can we do about it. So that's a bit of an overview of the talk. So why Go Dutch? Why have we selected this topic? And as you probably would have seen in the abstract, there was lots of talk about fossil fuels, about climate change, and I think now's a good moment to be talking about these things with hurricanes in the media. So hurricanes are extreme weather events that are driven by high temperatures, high surface temperatures on the sea, and all models suggest that they get worse in a context of climate change. And I think what we're seeing in Florida and also other parts of the world is basically a kind of premonition of what we could be seeing much more frequently around the world, which is not a pleasant future to be imagining. So really, that it's that high-level climate change stuff that's driving this, which is also driven by the science. So I think this is an entirely appropriate place to be talking about the scientific evidence on climate change. Now, you might think that cycling is quite disconnected from hurricanes, but actually there is a link, and that is CO2 emissions, which are driven by fossil fuels primarily, and transport is the, in the UK, the largest source of fossil CO2 emissions. It, according to official statistics, it accounts for around 40% of UK CO2 emissions when you take flying into account. So we do quite a lot of flying. The other reason it's important from a climate perspective, it's also globally the fastest growing source of emissions. And there's a very strong correlation between economic growth and transport-related CO2 emissions. So essentially, when people get rich, they can't eat more food. We have a limitation on the amount of food we can eat, or most people do, but we do not really have a limitation on how far we can fly. If you look at some CEOs, they're clocking up air miles like there's no tomorrow. And the same applies at the local level in terms of land transport. Wealthier people tend to commute further, and there's many people who will commute over 30 miles and back to get to work, which is obviously quite a large source of emissions. So that's a little bit of context. Why are we talking about Go Dutch? And this is obviously a huge problem, but cycling is one part of the solution, essentially. So I'm not making any grand claims to be able to solve the entire climate problem, but I believe that if everyone focuses on one part, or if we have experts in each area of the problem, then we can essentially solve the problem. So I have great trust that there are experts working in agriculture, looking at how to sequester CO2 emissions with new agricultural techniques. Housing, obviously a huge problem, and we need research there. And also other transport issues. So there's a huge amount to be said about demand reduction in transport. There's a huge amount of work to be done in public transport, car sharing. I'm focusing on cycling, which is one small part of the overall solution. There is no magic bullet to climate change. We need a wide diversity of interventions, and cycling certainly can provide part of the solution. So that's a bit of context. A little bit of context about how we ended up in the car-dominated system that we're in today. As someone relatively new to the field of transport modelling, I decided to do a bit of research into the history of the field. And it goes back basically to the 1940s, when you had the beginnings a very rapid increase in car ownership. And transport modelling as a discipline originates in this kind of context. This is San Francisco, and in the 1940s and early 1950s, there was very rapid uptake in the use of cars, and essentially local authorities were scrambling to try and work out how they could deal with this massive rise in demand. And I think that transport modelling has actually had a huge impact in the way that cities are designed. It's been the quantitative evidence coming from the transport modelling toolkits that have had a feedback into reality. So there's a feedback there where you, it's called predict and provide, where you predict car uptake, then you build for it, and then car uptake happens, and then you predict for more car uptake. So you get a kind of positive feedback loop between the modelling process and the reality of the road structure. So we are essentially trying to go back to transport modelling and say, well, can we use the same kind of techniques that the early transport modellers, who also had good intentions, they genuinely thought that the future was going to be all about a utopia where everyone had a car and there would be they didn't really know about the congestion problems that would occur. There was much less information about air pollution then, and natural resource depletion wasn't really on the radar. So I'm not blaming these guys. And in a sense, we are saying, how can we retool their models to be able to model a sustainable transport system? And as you'll see in subsequent slides, the fundamentals of the tools are quite similar. So although the overriding objective has changed, here we were looking to increase car capacity on the road network, and we're trying to, in a way, reduce the number of cars on the road. The same input data is there, and we've been doing this for a long time. So we know where the road network is, we know where trip attractors are, and we know where people live. So based on that information, we can estimate what the transport demand is likely to be and how it could change in the future. So that's basically the modelling, and modelling is very important to what we're doing, and I believe that if we have good models that enable us to envisage and quantify a sustainable future, it's more likely to happen in reality. So there are a few notes on transport modelling. With quite clear links to this previous slide, fast forward to 2017, this represents a relatively simple transport model that myself and colleagues have worked on, called the Propensity to Cycle tool. This is based on the same kind of data that we saw in the previous slide, with origins dotted around the city. This happens to be Leeds, and this is, I'm happy to say that it's actually a map of Leeds that's published in the final academic paper, and obviously you've got many attractors in Leeds city centre. What we're doing is we are starting off with the status quo, where we've got very low levels of cycling. So essentially red on this scale bar represents low levels of cycling, and the darkest red is 0 to 1% of people cycle to work. And then you've got 2 to 3% of people cycling to work in the kind of slightly yellow-red area. And then in the high cycling areas, we've got maybe up to 6% cycling. And that actually represents Headingley area and out to the northwest of Leeds. And what we can do with the computer model is to say, what would happen if that shifted to a Dutch scenario? So the Dutch in the title refers to Dutch levels of cycling. And if you look, it's probably a bit distant here, it's hard to see, but the blue here now represents anything blue is over 15% of people cycling to work. And it even goes above 20% in some areas near the city centre. Obviously, not everyone can cycle, and in some places are easier to cycle to work than others. If you live in the outskirts of Leeds, you're not going to cycle 10 kilometres to work. But everywhere represented here is within 5 kilometres of Leeds city centre. So it's actually accessible to many people. And I don't think this is an extreme scenario at all. We're only talking about 20% of trips to the city centre being made by bike here. So I think actions speak louder than words, and the great thing about technology is that increasingly we can make tools that are interactive. So while the transport modellers of old had to run their models once, it probably took them 3 days to run a model on a mainframe computer, and then they would print out the results. Now we can run them in a couple of minutes and make them available to the world via the internet. So I'm going to do a quick live demo of this propensity to cycle tool in action. So here we've got the Isle of Wight, which is our test area. And this is just to show how the modelling works and the kind of data that we're using. So essentially, we're taking data from the 2011 census, which most people would agree is a reliable source of information. Most people don't lie in the census, and it covers the majority of the working population. And we can see at the area level how many people are cycling. So in this area, in the Isle of Wight, we can see that there are just over 2,000 commuters, and 4% of them cycle. So that's pretty typical of the UK. The UK average is about 3%. Or we could look at another area down here where it's much lower levels, only 23 people cycle here. So this is information and data. And the point is that if we have good data, well, knowledge is power, and knowledge can be produced through information. And if we have good data, we have essentially power to help understand the transport system. Okay, so in this case, we can see that there is a high level of cycling, or relatively high level of cycling up here. The next question from a transport planning perspective is, how do we provide to those cyclists? We need to build cycle infrastructure somewhere. So again, this is from the 2011 census. We can see, if we click on this button, and I should reduce the screen resolution slightly. If I move this slider, we can see where people are travelling. So from this perspective, we've moved from the area-based level analysis of cycling to the desire line. And we can see that this is quite relatively well-used route. 57 people said that they went from this area to this area. So again, that's a useful piece of information. Maybe we would want to build a cycle path along here. So that's the next level of visualising the data that we can get out of the census. And I should also say at this moment that all of this so far is based on open data. So anyone can access it. And that's a big change compared with 10 years ago, where this data either didn't exist or was not in a format that people could analyse, let alone publish on a publicly accessible map. So going to the next level, your transport planner is likely to want to know precisely what roads we could build on. And this starts to give you down to the road level, which are the most commonly used roads for cycling on. And then the final layer that I'm going to show you, I'm just going to remove the zones for now, is at the route network level. And again, it's hard to see, but you come up, if you add together all of those lines and put them on the road network, you get an estimate of where everyone could be cycling. And this is the beginnings of what could be a cycling network in the Isle of Wight, which is just an example, just a case study. So if I go back to the area level, and click on show zones, the Go Dutch in the title refers to the shift that's possible between the 2011, which basically is the current level of cycling. It hasn't changed much since 2011, and to a Go Dutch future. If I click on this, you can see that suddenly the level of cycling on the Isle of Wight has changed massively, and it's gone to over 20% on many of the island, many parts of the island. But interestingly, it's not even all the way across. So areas that are closer to Newport, which is the main employment centre, have higher expected levels of cycling. So how do we use that information? Well, we can use exactly the same visualisation techniques as we did for the 2011 census to estimate where to build. So if we look at the straight lines, you can see that they have shifted quite dramatically towards the city centre. And this is a rough outline of, in very simple terms, of where people could be commuting in this system. And again, you can go on, you can put those back onto the road network, and you can begin to design a cycling network for your entire area for the Isle of Wight. Obviously, the Isle of Wight is a relatively small part of a much bigger problem, which is the whole of the UK and ultimately the whole world. But the same kind of data and the same kind of problems exist worldwide. So can we take this method and scale it up? And that's where the big data part of our work comes into play. So I'm just going to go back to the slides. Okay, so how does this play out in Leeds? So I've actually today have rerun some of these models for Leeds to generate the results. I should say at the outset though that we have done this for all of the UK, and the results, if it works. I know what's happening here. So the results now, for all of the UK, I've just shown the results for the Isle of Wight, are available, publicly available on this website at www.pct.bike. We've got a nice little video that introduces it there with some of our colleagues in the University of Cambridge and myself featuring in that video. And essentially, we can imagine what it would look like for all of the UK. Obviously, Leeds is part of, for all of England. So the motivation behind this specific project was to model cycling uptake and where cycling potential is highest in the UK. Everyone knows that building cycle paths can increase uptake of cycling, but no one has really answered the question, where do you build? So in terms of the propensity to cycle tool, this is funded by central government. It's funded by the Department for Transport, and we've been working on this for 2.5 years, so it's not like this is something we created yesterday. And already it's being used by local authorities to help decide where to build new cycling infrastructure. And I'm just going to go through the results for Leeds in the same way that we saw for the Isle of Wight. Where is cycling potential highest, and what does that mean for Leeds? So within Leeds as a city, I'm just going to try and get this screen so you can see the... is that any better? Not really. Yeah, so at least you can see the scale there. So you can see dark blue is 40% cycling, and dark red here is 0%. What does this tell us? West Yorkshire is a cycling desert. That's what it tells us. So although some of the best sports cyclists in the world are from Yorkshire, it's not a very good place in terms of cycle commuting, which is a good proxy for utility cycling. And especially in Bradford, and actually in terms of the statistics, Bradford has a high proportion of ethnic minorities, and that plays out in the statistics on cycling, that you're much less likely to cycle if you're from certain ethnic groups. And the same actually applies in terms of cycle commuting. There's a big gender imbalance in cycling. You're much more likely to cycle if you're a man than a woman, and there's a lot of research into that and why that is and why that may be. But there's a caveat to that. In the Netherlands, there's no disparity between men and women. In fact, older women are more likely to cycle than younger men. And it's relatively flat all across different population bands. And we did some research that looked at how the proportion of how the gender split of cycling varies across local authorities. And we found one local authority that basically has almost Dutch levels of cycling is Cambridge. And in Cambridge, men and women cycle equally to work. So what that's telling us is that if we're looking for a high cycling future, it's going to be something that's accessible for everyone. So therefore, we cannot be building cycling infrastructure and cycling policies for Bradley Wiggins. We need to be building cycling infrastructure for everyone. So that's a major point. Yes?
The boundaries on your map there, are they local authority wards or are they super affluent areas?
Very good question. So these are, the technical term is medium super alpa areas. They, I think, are slightly larger than wards, but I'm not sure. And there's roughly 7,000 people in them. Does that match up with the ward boundaries?
They'd probably be smaller than the average local authority.
Yeah, there's 107 in these, isn't it? 107, something like that?
In terms of MSOA, I believe so, yeah. That sounds, about 100. So in terms of the origin destination data, I know that there's roughly 10,000 combinations between origins and destinations. So if it's 100, it works out right. So we actually have data on a higher level of geographic resolution. So we can drill down to the LSOA level, which is something I can show you later. But in terms of showing the broad pattern, I think it's good that we can see beyond just Leeds and see how it relates to the rest of West Yorkshire. Leeds isn't famous for cycling, but this part up in northwest Leeds is actually basically, relatively speaking, a cycling oasis compared with the desert of surrounding areas. So that's the same map. The talk is Go Dutch, so I'm just going to go straight ahead and say what would it look like if we went Dutch. And the change is pretty dramatic, to be honest. So just wait for it to load. There we go. Finally, it's decided to. And the point here, this is where my geographical hat comes on. There have been projections of how cycling could grow nationally, but very few people have said what the geographical distribution of that growth is. And people just assume that everywhere is going to grow equally. But it's ridiculous to think that places that are far away to the city centre can ever have the same rate of cycling than people who live here, whose average trip distances is much, much less. So that's essentially what our model does. And I'm very quickly going to show some information of how we've done this. So just to emphasise, so there's no confusion, we haven't made these numbers up. All of these numbers are based on real data.
from a reliable source, which is the 2011 census. And hopefully if this stays there, you can see that this is a good example going out to Northwest Leeds, and we've got numbers. Again, this is what we're all about. Numbers speak louder than words in this context. We've got 1,200 making this trip between the MSOA called Leeds 109 to Leeds 111. The baseline cyclist is actually very high. There's 105 making it currently, but under a Go Dutch scenario, which may sound extreme, but actually we're only reaching 24. We're only reaching 301 of those cyclists. So anyone who said, "Well, not everyone can cycle, therefore your model is wrong because we're not saying that everyone's going to be cycling." And we've got an estimate of what the what that means for the change in drivers. And it's, again, not hugely dramatic. It's 70 cars off the road, assuming that cycling replaces cars equally as all other modes. And we know how far it is, 4.4 kilometres, which, again, isn't asking you to be Bradley Wiggins or any other professional cyclist to do that. So that's the data. How does the modelling work? Again, I'm not going to go into any great detail, but I will say that there's a paper on the subject, and you can find that online. And again, I'm just going to try and move this so we're more in the centre, so we can see the model output page. So for every region, we basically generate a map that shows an overview of the commuting pattern, and this basically just shows the kind of spatial structure of the area. Obviously, if we looked at Manchester, it would be very different. Leeds is what's called a monocentric city, where everyone tends to go to the city centre and then out again, which is what tends to create congestion along the arterial routes. Whereas somewhere like Manchester is a lot more polymorphic, where you have loads of sub-centres. And we need to take that into account when we're planning for a sustainable transport system. We can't just build the same thing everywhere. We need to build it on the existing transport structure. I'm just going down. We're taking hilliness into account. So we can see that hilly areas are actually much harder to cycle in. That's yet another... That's another problem where people say, aha, you cannot have a high cycling potential in West Yorkshire because it's too hilly. Not true. It will reduce demand for cycling, but it won't make it impossible. And in fact, when we compared our model, when we compared the data for the UK with data from the Netherlands, we found that based on this model, assuming that the UK was as flat as a pancake, like the Netherlands is, you'd have about 50% more cycling. So hilliness is not the only answer. And again, there's raininess as well, but you only need to look at the Netherlands or look at Switzerland, where you've got high levels of cycling, to know that's not the ultimate barrier.
Switzerland, well, given you've got all this propensity to cycling information,
yeah.
Why do you think they put the cycle superhighway where they did from Seacroft to Bradford?
Yeah, okay, so that's a good question. He's asked, given that you've got all this data, why did they build the spend £30 million on the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway? Hold that thought, I'll come back to it. I will. And if I don't, you can hold me to it, but I will. I'm not sidestepping that. I'm going to talk about that later.
Bristol's quite hilly, and it has quite a high level of cycling, relatively high, isn't it?
Yeah. Bristol's about 5%, and it's slightly hillier than here. So, I used to live in Sheffield, and because typical sample size n equals one, I cycle, therefore it's not a problem. I used to say it's not a problem at all, but when you actually run the models, it does have an effect. Hilliness definitely does have an impact. Just to continue with this demonstration for the results for West Yorkshire. So this is at the West Yorkshire level, not just Leeds. So the wider West Yorkshire area that's got about 2 million people in it.
we can see how the percentage of cyclists change from scenario to scenario. So, as I say, West Yorkshire, of the combined authorities, has the lowest current level of cycling to work of any local authority, which was something that surprised me when I first looked at this data. And data is about challenging assumptions. And you can see that the percentage cycling is increasing through all scenarios. However, overall, it's not getting as high as it does in cities such as Hull, where obviously it's flat and trip distances are lower. So we're not building a model that's unrealistic. We're taking into account local factors. And we've also got percent car drivers. And again, to me, this illustrates that we're going to have to do more than cycling policies if we're going to tackle the car congestion problem. We've only removed 13 percentage points from the percent of people who cycle. So I believe that Sadiq Khan in London wants to get he wants to get 80% of all trips by active travel and public transport, which basically squeezes cars down to 20%. If we only do cycling and we go for a very optimistic level, under our model, we still only reach 50%. So that tells me we're going to have to do car sharing, and we're still going to have to do public transport interventions as well. And then we've got all other modes in there as well. So that's just to talk about how it compares with other modes.
So I don't want to start a flow, but I mean, I'm interested that the walking has gone down, because another thing you could do, if you, I don't know whether you've got plans for this, but like joint modelling for walking and cycling, you might see a different picture. You know.
I agree. I think, so as I said, we have modelled cycling taking away from all modes.
Okay.
So we're mode neutral other than cycling. Gets... But our model does actually assume that there's a switch between walking and cycling. We had a debate among ourselves as whether we should hold walking equal. And in reality, if you have policies that promote cycling, usually they promote walking as well. So they make streets safer and they just make the space much more livable. So again, these are the results. And this is not certainly something that I wouldn't emphasise on there. So that's a good point. Yeah.
Would you say something about the e-bikes?
Yes, certainly. So e-bikes is a scenario that, if Go Dutch is a kind of ambitious vision, e-bikes is blue skies. So e-bike scenario assumes that everyone has Dutch propensity to cycle, that we have a Dutch cycling culture, and also that we have, everyone's got an electric bike. And that's something that's really exciting. It's really taken off in Germany and the Netherlands, which in terms of cycling are kind of bellwethers for where we might be heading. And there is gradual uptake of e-bikes in the UK, and something fantastic about electric bikes is that they overcome the hilliness problem, because they can go up hills, and also they make cycling 5 kilometres more accessible to everyone. So that's why, in terms of the car drivers, you see a very big drop, because they can go further, they're more able to replace car drivers. So in terms of the modelling, that means that we've replaced, we've taken Dutch data on people who use e-bikes and applied it to UK travel behaviour. So that's the kind of blue skies vision of where we could go. In terms of, if anyone's interested in the statistics and the modelling, I'm certainly not going to show any equations, but I think that visuals really can tell a story. Obviously, you're much less likely to cycle a long distance than a short distance. So on the x-axis here, we've got route distance in kilometres. This is where you're getting people cycling pretty far away, often along Otley Road, who are saying, you meet people who are like, yes, I cycle 10 kilometres. I know a guy called Ian Keller who I think it's more like 15 kilometres he cycles in. But in any case, that's clearly going to reduce the number of people who are cycling that distance. And what we've got on the y-axis is just the number of commuters. And the red line here is by any mode. So these are people driving in, and every area has a signature curve on it. Some of them drop down very dramatically, like Oxford and Cambridge. You have a very kind of small and condensed city centre, and that's one thing that makes it easier for them to have a high level of cycling. Even though this looks very steep compared with other cities, this is quite a slow decline as you get further, and that's affecting it. And our model simply estimates the percentage of people who could cycle by distance along the different distance bands. And obviously, it's much more possible, it's much more likely that someone will cycle 3 kilometres than they will 10 kilometres. So that's why we have very dramatic drop-off, even in the Go Dutch scenario. And in fact, this is a useful fact about our model. The average distance cycled in the Go Dutch scenario is less than the average distance cycled in the current situation. So we're not about people cycling further distances, we're just about replacing more short trips that are currently driven and made by other modes by cycling. So that's a little bit on the modelling, and we're using distance and hilliness to estimate cycling uptake. So that's a little bit on the modelling and some data from West Yorkshire. I'm not actually going to show the next slides, partly because this is all available on pct.bike. So if you're really interested in this, feel free to just go to pct.bike and then you can visit the results for West Yorkshire. You just click on it. I'm going to talk a little bit about Leeds because this is the local authority that we're in. So if I go back to the slides, here are some numbers that I pulled out today for Leeds, and it's interesting to compare the numbers. I seem to remember that the percentage cycling in West Yorkshire as a region, which has got many rural areas and quite a high average trip distance, I think it was 13. In West Yorkshire, it's higher. In Leeds, because it's a relatively high density city, most people in that local authority can access the city centre. It's higher at 16%. The current level is it's about 1.9%, so 2. So you can see quite a dramatic shift. The thing that's going to be of real interest from the perspective of health and air pollution is the number of car drivers going into the city centre. And essentially, this shows that under our model of cycling uptake, we've gone down from just over 190,000 to just under 70,000. So we're moving 20,000 cars from the roads of Leeds and in the rush hour peak every day into this scenario. So that's from that you can start to estimate the pollution and the health benefits. And going back to the motivations of this research, the CO2 savings. So we can start moving towards a much more efficient system. And we've got massive uptake of cycling. This represents almost a tenfold increase in cycling. So there's some numbers. In the propensity to cycle tool team, Malcolm Morgan, who's in the audience actually, is at Leeds, but it's very much a multi-university project. And we have some health modellers on the team, and they've turned these health savings into pound signs. I'm not going to go into the details of how they do that, but it is quite a detailed methodology that's approved by the World Health Organization. So they're using established standards to estimate the health benefits. And the numbers come out pretty big, actually. 24 million per year just for the cycle commuting. That's not taking into account cycling to school or cycling to see for leisure trips. So if we're talking about funding the kind of cycling infrastructure that we need to get to Dutch levels, we can turn to the health savings and the number one biggest source of savings.
And, you know, talking about the NHS and pressures on the NHS, if there were a magic pill that you could give someone that was relatively low cost, that improved your mental health as well as your physical health and reduced the probability of many types of disease, people would sell it for millions and millions of pounds. But walking and cycling, just building physical activity into your everyday life, provides that benefit. So the NHS is getting very interested in these kind of numbers.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Does that include the improvement in air quality as well? No. Or is it just the benefit to the
No. Society? So I think that's a subsequent bullet point. So it does not... The answer to your question is on there. That does not include improved air quality. Anyone who's interested, make a note of HEAT. That stands for HEAT Economic Assessment Tool. And it does take into account...
Health.
Yeah. What did I say, sorry?
Heat economic.
I said heat economic, sorry. Health. It's heat and it's health. Yeah, heat health economic methodology. It certainly does not include the health benefits of climate change mitigation. So climate change, as we're seeing in Florida at the moment, does actually in the long run have a huge impact on health. It's an indirect impact and it's difficult to quantify, but it's very focused on things that are relatively well known. So this will take into account diabetes, heart disease. They're the ones that can easily be quantified. And again, I'm not the health modeller on the team. I'm more the geographic data analyst. What about improved traffic safety levels? So there's a lot of co-benefits. Cycling policies, there's many ways to promote cycling, but some of them mean creating car-free city centres, like what they've done in Ljubljana, like what they've done in many European cities, where not for cycling, but to try and attract more tourists, they've said, let's get cars out of the city centre and let's get more people into the restaurants. All of these things can improve road traffic safety levels. It does not take into account the improvement in car traffic accidents or the wider benefits that I've already talked about. The geographic distribution of cycling, I think I've talked about that a fair amount. One thing that I should say though, if we go back to the map, is that, and I've touched on it earlier, but within Leeds is a case, Leeds is a very interesting case study, because at the moment, and again it's taking a long time to load, so while it is, we can see that currently the cycling is very biased towards the north of Leeds. The south of Leeds receives relatively low levels. And as we shift to Go Dutch, the geographic distribution shifts quite dramatically. And preempting the question about the Leeds-Bradford cycle superhighway, you can see that if you are building for current cyclists, which I think is a logical thing to do, you'd go on this north-south line, and even under the Go Dutch, you would also do that. But of course, there are many, many lines. So I'm just going to zoom out again. So here we're only showing the top 30 lines. If we show the top 100, you can see there that basically there's demand from all over. I would say that the north-south corridor has more potential, but there is some potential going east-west. So getting towards the question... I think they were aiming for trying to provide a cycling option to deprived areas, and they were also looking at long-term scenarios of cycling uptake, not so much the the short-term uptake. Of course, there's many, many hundreds. Well, there's about 10,000 combinations of these desire lines just in Leeds. And when you add them all together, it looks something like this. And this is something that I can say Leeds created this nationwide. So specifically, Malcolm Morgan, who sat in the audience, did all of the amazing work that led this to be possible. And if you have any questions about this specific element, I'm sure he'll be willing to answer it. But I think in terms of big data, this is a really impressive piece of work. This thing scales all across the UK, and you can see the dense networks. Basically, it's where you've got high population densities linking to where you've got high levels of cycling. To zoom back into Leeds, so what are we? We're under a Go Dutch scenario. In fact, there is actually quite high potential. This is roughly where the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway is. It's not a bad place to build a cycle path if you're thinking in the long term. But neither is this road up to the northwest. Neither is this route up to the north. Neither is this up to the out to the east. And neither are any of these other arterial routes. So why did they focus on just this one? I think it's partly because if you're going for a large grant, this was 30 million in a short amount of time, you need a simple scheme. And rather than saying, oh, well, we're going to build a network of 20 cycle paths that takes a very long time to design, bear in mind, this didn't exist. This data and this analysis didn't exist. It was very difficult. And someone who is involved in the design of the Leeds Cycle Superhighway has said to me, I wish 3 years ago we had your tool, and then we would have maybe designed it slightly differently. To me, it clearly shows that you need to build a network rather than a single cycle path. And what's really good news is that local authorities now are starting to build networks. They're designing a strategic cycling network rather than this is our path, this is our one cycle path. It doesn't work like that. And that is something that I can say the propensity to cycle tool has had an impact on local authority planning. This is now endorsed by the Department for Transport. So this is the tool that local authorities are being recommended to use. And local authorities, including Leeds, hopefully, will be using this to design future cycling networks. So that's a little bit about the geographic distribution, and the main point, I think I got slightly sidetracked by the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway. To me, that's not the point. It's part of a network. If you've got the rest of the network in place, people will use it. It's just that the surrounding network and the culture isn't there, so it's not being used to the extent possible. If we go back in time, back to 2011, which is basically where we're at now, there hasn't been much change since 2011. You can see this is actually Otley Road, which we're on just about, the most cycled route in Leeds, and down in the south, very low levels of cycling. So the question there, and there's no right answer here, if you're an engineer, should you build for the current cyclists, or should you build where there's high potential but very low levels of cycling currently? My opinion has changed over time. I used to say, oh, you should build everywhere. But having seen some of the politics around the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway, I now think it's very important to build where there's already cycling happening and build gradually from that core. So if I were speaking to Leeds City Council, I'd say, you've got to provide for your existing cyclists at the moment. So prioritise those guys and then build your network kind of organically out from there. And that's based on the evidence that I've seen on cycling. Okay, so where do we go next? We've got data now. That's something we didn't have 10 years ago. So we're actually in a very fortunate position. We know all of the benefits of cycling in much more detail than we did in the past. So what can we do with it? Well, I'm going to answer that question on two levels. So on the first level, in terms of my own research, the logical question and the question that has come from local authorities is, okay, fair enough, this is where cycling potential is, but how do you convert cycling potential into what you actually build on the ground? So how can we design a strategic cycling network? And this flow diagram, which again was created by Malcolm Morgan, just shows a workflow where we can classify existing infrastructure, how we can define a set of interventions to represent changes to those, and then we can evaluate how many people will start cycling as a result. There has been a debate in the past that is sometimes framed as Sustrans versus Cycling UK, which are two big cycling charities. Sustrans tends to favour, or tended to favour, off-road cycling. Cycling UK, which tended to be CTC, and the more hardened cyclists were like, no, you should be able to ride on the roads anywhere. You don't need so much cycling infrastructure. Those two positions have converged to say, actually, when you look at the evidence, if you want to get the masses cycling, you need off-road provision. That debate has basically been sorted. So that's why the next step is to focus, instead of changing behaviour, which is what we've looked at in the propensity to cycle tool, how do you represent changes in infrastructure that could facilitate this change in behaviour? If there's no infrastructure, there will be no cycling revolution, essentially. Okay, next step for Leeds. Anyone guess what this is? So, with all this big data and evidence, this is what we can come up with. This is a flagship design, and judging by the reaction, I think people can probably guess what this is already. So, I looked at the comments underneath the Yorkshire Post article on this, and someone said, was this designed by a 12-year-old? Question mark. I don't know who it was designed by, but what I do know is they didn't get the money. So that didn't happen. Sorry. The trolley bus did not happen, and we're almost at the end of the slide, so I won't let it out of its misery. I'll let this slide continue, and we can all imagine what we could have had. So I'm sorry if there's any NGT. I don't actually know what NGT stands for.
New Generation Transport
and trolley bus engineers. Did anyone design the scheme in the audience? Okay, that's good. So the best, I'm going to fast forward here. The best map I can find, and I would hope that the maps that we are creating for the propensity cycle tour are slightly more detailed than the maps that we were given for the trolley bus. This is the best map I could find. And in this, in the website where I got this map from, it said it was 250 million pounds for one network. Okay, so some of that money has been reallocated to Leeds. I think this is still current. I don't know if it's still to play for, but essentially it has been stated by the powers that be that £170 million of funding will be reallocated to transport schemes in Leeds. So 6 months ago, I could not answer this question. I was always fascinated by it. What could you build for £170 million? Now, thanks to Department for Transport funding on a follow-on project to the propensity to cycle tool, and thanks to again to Malcolm's amazing work on this, we can and also thanks to good research, where a load of researchers have actually gone and asked the difficult questions: how much does it cost to build these things? So the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway initial report comes out at £1.15 million per kilometre. That may seem like a lot of money, but wait until you see
the cost of what you can actually build for 173 million. And then obviously this is kind of the cycle superhighway. This is the Rolls Royce or the Campagnolo, to use a cycling metaphor of cycling infrastructure. There's many other things you can do that cost less money. Okay, so this is 250 million gives you 10 kilometres. That's 25 million per kilometre. Okay, if you do the maths, and it's roughly 1 million per kilometre, well, you can get almost 200 kilometres. So in Leeds, these are results that are fresh out of the oven. And we're doing the same methodology using big data nationwide. We think for under 170 million, we can get 70 kilometres of cycle lanes. That means this is relatively cheap and light intervention, so just signalled cycle paths. These are roads where you don't have much traffic, so cyclists can go without feeling like they're going to get killed. Cycle streets, which is essentially your painted lines, and you can get 36 kilometres of segregated cycle track and 40 kilometres of step cycle tracks. And we've costed up all of those based on the report that I mentioned earlier. And we've got here the cost per kilometre. You can see these ones are very expensive. This one's about 10 times cheaper, the cycle street. And the cycle lanes are roughly halfway between the two. Sorry, I think I got those the wrong way around. The cycle street is the relatively cheap interventions, and the cycle lanes are where you have painted paint on your road. And this is a preliminary uptake based on Highways of England advice note. So this is going back to Highways England, who have looked at this in detail. I've mentioned the headline figures. It does not include junction remodelling, which is basically taking a roundabout and making it safe for cyclists, which costs a lot of money. And I've generated an interactive map because I've done enough interactive mapping so far. I'm just going to skip on to the results for one part of Leeds that I know relatively well. I live just opposite Potter Newton Park, round about here, so go somewhere I know. And this is not me biasing the results, I promise. It says there should be a segregated cycle path on Scott Hall Road. If anyone knows Scott Hall Road, it's two lanes both ways. Plus, at the top end, you've got a trolley bus lane that is hardly ever used. I think having gone through it,
a guided busway.
You've got a guided busway going up half of it that hardly ever gets used. I play football up there, and I've seen it in use maybe twice out of 100 times. So I think there's potential there. Also, at Meanwood Valley, I'm not quite sure. We've got an algorithm that's doing this. So we're focusing on developing the algorithm. We're not building this network ourselves. We're letting the rules of the computer generate it automatically. And it's saying there should be a cycle lane down here, which is kind of light segregation. And then you've got step cycle tracks on some of the other paths. If you extend that vision out, you can imagine what that would look like all across Leeds. And this is part of the Leeds-wide network that would cost 120 million. So much, much less than that single 10-kilometre route. We've got over 150 kilometres of cycling infrastructure to build a cycle network. So I think to some extent that goes back to the question of why did they build the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway? That cost £30 million. If they had more money, they could have built a network rather than just that place, and they probably would have prioritised it differently if they were looking at the same evidence that I'm looking at. But this is recent evidence, so I'm not going to blame anyone in particular for that.
Can you just be a bit more explicit about what you mean by a step cycle track?
I can. So, have you been on the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway?
No.
Okay, so the step cycle track is, if you have a really wide pavement, or you want to extend the pavement, it's about having part of the pavement for pedestrians, and then you have a step, so you've got vertical displacement, and you've got a curve, but usually it's a kind of beveled curve that's not dangerous for cycling, so that you're at least raised a little bit above the level of the road. The reason why it's important is that when you've only got the painted line, you can have buses, taxis, lorries that don't see it or just go into that. So it creates a physical barrier. So that's a good question. Thanks for that. And basically it's saying it's a mixture. In the same way that the climate problem can't be solved by a golden bullet, this is a complex system, and we need to think intelligently about a whole series of interventions that are actually quite intricate and complex, rather than one single grand scheme to solve it all, like the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway. So it's a different way of thinking. Going back to that, it's actually quite difficult to design and prioritise these if you're doing it by hand. If you're just running on intuition, how would you know where to go? But if you have an algorithm to automatically generate these things, we don't think that people should take this and build it exactly. It needs a bit of planner's expertise to say, well, actually, we can double up with the guided busway here. Down here, we can link up with something else. We can build a cut through. So we think this should be interpreted and not just built as is. But moving on, this is getting close to my final point now, Paul, so we can definitely talk about this more later on over a pint. But I don't want to sound like a cycling zealot. I think cycling needs to be part of an overall sustainable transport system. It's not just about cycling. And if you have growth of public transport, that can go hand in hand with growth in cycling. So if you want to build, let's say we're building, this is just kind of quite abstract, cycle lanes between two settlements, public transport links between two settlements, you can boost the usage of that public transport by encouraging people to walk and cycle rather than taking the car between the two. So you can actually get a huge amount of mutual benefit. There's also potential for costs. So in the context of HS2, if you build a bloody great railway line and you've got two settlements in between, it's going to be hard. So you need to build bridges and you need to take account for that. But you can also have another co-benefit in terms of the parallel. So there's two potential co-benefits. And if we see public transport and cycling and walking as part of this wider shift towards sustainable transport infrastructure, then we can really realise the benefits. So this is my final slide. This is just next steps that I would see. I've talked about what we can do as modellers and what the next steps for our research are, but just thinking, if you wanted to help create cycling momentum, political momentum around cycling in Leeds, well, I think you need a vision of what a strategic cycle network could look like. If you can see it and imagine it and draw it, suddenly it becomes one step closer to reality. And the Bristol Cycling Campaign, Bristol was mentioned earlier, they actually created a tube map of where they thought the key routes would be, and they got a huge amount of interest and public support by doing that. Make it evidence, so e.g. using some of the tools that have been created at Leeds, and I'm very happy to collaborate with people interested in doing that. Create costings of estimated benefits and costs. And also, if you've got competing schemes or maybe collaborative schemes, compare those benefits and costs with other schemes. If someone says that's too expensive, you can say, well, how much will the resurfacing budget in 2018 be for Leeds? You can start working things out. And certainly, this is something that I've found, integrate with other public transport modes. Don't just be, oh, it's all about cycling, or oh, it's all about walking. That integration step is actually really important. and linked in with the council. I don't think there's any representatives of Leeds City Council in here, not that I know of. It would be great to link up with them, and that's something that we're looking to do, but I think it's really beneficial to link up. So, final plug, every Monday is my volunteering day at a place called Peddler's Arms. It's a cycle repair cooperative in Leeds, and it's another assumption that's hidden in our model, is that Go Dutch assumes that everyone has access to a good working bicycle, but many people do not. So that's another part of the problem. If we're going to have a cycling culture, everyone's going to have a lot more bikes and bikes that work well. So this is just a plug. There's places to go there to fix your bike. If you're into tinkering, it's a great place to meet people and use your skills. And I've got a little photo of it there. So that's my final plug.
Where is it?
It's in Mabgate. So just off the A61 as it comes into Leeds, past the roundabout, past the Shell garage down there. But peddlersarms.org is a plug of what we can do down at the very local level. So I think we need to see this problem as part of a very big problem, up to, you know, big climate change issues, and then down to the local level and even at the individual level. So I think that's a really lovely note to finish off. Everyone can do something. It's not just about leaving the experts to model it. And let's go and create a sustainable transport system for Leeds. So thank you very much for listening.
Thanks a lot, Robin. Now, I'm sure there's plenty of material there for questions and discussion about that afterwards. But after we have a shorter break, if we get, you know, as quick as we can to get you know, do what you want to do for five minutes or so. Then we'll be back. We'll quiz you some more.
Yeah,
quiz you.
Yeah, very happy for questions. I should have said that, yeah.
I think it was actually my halo.